and dusky rivers, and my soul has grown deep like the rivers, like the...
On Sunday, April 6th at 11 p.m., Sugar in My Bowl kicks off our Jazz Appreciation and National Poetry Month celebration with a look at Langston Hughes. We will talk to Hughes biographer Arnold Rampersand, and we will take a look at a production of Hughes's Ask Your Mama with Dr. Ron McCurdy, professor of music at the Thornton School of Music, University of Southern California. That's Sunday, April 6th at 11 p.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web. Well, it appears as though my promo was not downloaded. I send it to people, and anyway, the promo that I sent for those on Facebook know that tonight's program focuses on Langston Hughes. This is National Poetry Month and International Jazz Month, and so we are celebrating with poets, writers, poets in particular. And this week's focus will be Langston Hughes. We're going to start off the program with we're going to start off with the voice of Langston Hughes. And then we're going to go into the music that was used on the promo that was not downloaded, that you didn't get a chance to hear. In any event, stay tuned. This is indeed WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. And the name of this program is what?
In my book.
This is The Negro Speaks of Rivers, one of my earliest poems, written in 1920, just after I came out of high school. The way this poem came to be written was that I was going to Mexico to visit my father, who lived in Mexico City, and on the train going across the Mississippi River, just outside St. Louis, I looked out the window and I saw this great muddy river flowing down toward the heart of the South, and I began to think about what this river meant to the Negro people, how, in a sense, our history was linked to this river, how in slavery time, my grandmother told me that to be sold down the Mississippi was one of the worst things that could happen to a Negro slave. And then I remembered that I'd read about Abraham Lincoln going down the Mississippi as a young man, and he went on a raft to New Orleans, and he saw human beings bought and sold in the slave market there, and he was so horrified by this that he never forgot it. And many years later, of course, we know that it was Lincoln who signed the Emancipation Proclamation. And so, as the train went on into the gathering dusk, because it had been about sunset when we crossed the river, I took my father's letter out of my pocket and began to write down on the back of his letter this poem, The Negro Speaks of Rivers. I've known rivers. I've known rivers ancient as the world and older than the flow of human blood in human veins. My soul has grown deep like the rivers. I bathed in the Euphrates when dawns were young. I built my hut near the Congo, and it lulled me to sleep. I looked upon the Nile and raised the pyramids above it. I heard the singing of the Mississippi when Abe Lincoln went down to New Orleans, and I've seen its muddy bosom turn all golden in the sunset. I've known rivers, ancient, dusky rivers. My soul has grown deep like the rivers.
Inspired by a poem written by Langston Hughes. I'm sure most of you have heard of Langston Hughes. And he wrote a poem about rivers. And we call this song, I've Known Rivers.
Seen and rivers I have known, ancient than the world and older than the blood. I've known rivers, I've known rivers, all through Africa and North America, South America and Australia. I've known rivers, I've known rivers. I've known rivers in the north and the south. I've known rivers in the east and the west. I've known rivers all over this world. I've sailed some and seen the rest. I've known rivers. I've known rivers. I've known rivers. Ancient dusky rivers. And my soul has grown deep. Like the rivers, the rivers, the rivers. Like the rivers I have seen. Rivers I have known, ancient than the world, and older than the blood. I've known rivers, I've known rivers, all through Africa and the north of America, in South America and Australia. I've known rivers, I've known rivers. I've known rivers in the north and the south. I've known rivers in the east and the west. I've known rivers all over this world. I've sailed some and seen the rest. I've known rivers. I've known rivers. I've known rivers. Ancient dusky rivers. And my soul has grown deep. Like the rivers, the rivers, the rivers. Like the
rivers I have known, ancient than the world and are older than the blood. I've known rivers, I've known rivers, all through Africa and North America, South America and Australia. I've known rivers, I've known rivers. I've known rivers in the north and the south. I've known rivers in the east and the west. I've known rivers all over this world. I've sailed some and seen the rest. I've known rivers, I've known rivers. I've known rivers, ancient dusky rivers, and my soul has grown deep. Like the river, the river, the river, like the rivers I have known, the rivers I have seen, ancient than the world and older than the blood. I've known rivers, I've known rivers, all through Africa and North America, South America and Australia. I've known rivers, I've known rivers. I've known rivers in the north and south. I've known rivers in the east and the west. I've known rivers all over this world. I've sailed some and seen rivers. I've known rivers, I've known rivers, ancient dusky rivers, and my soul has grown deep like the river.
Hi, my name's Joyce Jones, and I am on the phone with
Arnold Rampersad. I'm a retired professor at Stanford University. I was a professor in the humanities. My appointment was in the English department, teaching American literature, specialty African-American literature, and my main subject were publications concerned with biography and also some work in autobiography.
Thank you so much, Arnold Rampersad, for joining Sugar in My Bowl.
My pleasure.
Tell me a little bit about you and what led you to create the two-volume work on Langston Hughes.
Well, that's a longish story. To cut it down as much as possible, I did a PhD in American literature in the early 1970s. I wrote a book on W.B. Du Bois called The Art and Imagination of W.B. Du Bois. Took a job at Stanford, and then one year I went off to be a visiting professor of Afro-American studies at Harvard University, where one day I met the man who had been Hughes's secretary, George Houston Bass, and who had become his literary executor. And he told me one day that he had read my Du Bois book, liked it, that he was in control of the Langston Hughes papers, which were at and are at Yale University in the Beinecke Library, and that he had been looking for a biographer, and was I interested in being Hughes's biographer? And I said, absolutely, even though I didn't know what I was getting into. I began to do the research that eventually led to a two-volume biography of Langston Hughes.
Oh, and that's a great, great work you have there. It's definitely the go-to. It is The Life of Langston Hughes. I focused more on volume 2, 1941 through 1967, I Dream a World. And let's see, the volume 1.
Volume 1 is I Too Sing America, and it goes from 1902, when Hughes was born, to roughly speaking around 1940-41, and it breaks the life in half. And I'm very partial to volume 1, but I can see why you would be interested in volume 2, since your main interest right now is, in this case, is on jazz.
Right.
But blues and jazz were very important to Langston Hughes from the 1920s on. I mean, they're very much a part of his poetical world, his inspiration, very close to the source of everything important in Langston Hughes. So the story of blues and jazz with Hughes goes back to the 1920s and even before, because he said that he talked about how, as a child growing up in Lawrence, Kansas, he would hear blues being sung, and it took a while for him to be able to incorporate that kind of music into his poetry, but when he did do so, he really found his voice, you know?
The Louis Armstrong of New Orleans, born on the 4th of July, 1900, as a young man played his trumpet on the Mississippi River boats. Into Louis's playing crept the blue notes of the field hollers and the plantation songs he'd heard, and the brightness of ragtime, and the loneliness of the big old muddy river, and the happiness of dancing people on the boats where he played. Louis put these things all together, lifted his horn to his lips, and played like this. That's Louis. His nickname is Satchmo. All through his early music run the strains of the blues. Nobody knows who first made up the songs called the blues, but their three-line, 12-bar form has since become a standard pattern in American music. Certainly the blues show traces of the work songs, the field hollers, and the plantation cries of the Deep South. The blues. Maybe one hot day, a man was working in a rice field when a song came into his head, then out of his mouth. A song with words, perhaps like this. Oh, the sun is so hot and the day is so doggone long. Then when he couldn't think of anything else right away to go with it, he repeated the same lines. Yes, the sun is so hot and the day is so doggone long. But by that time, maybe he had a new thought. So he sang, and that is the reason I'm singing this doggone song. Something like that must have happened the day the first blues was born, for that is the pattern of the blues, a 12-bar musical pattern, one long line of four bars which is repeated, words and music, then a third line of four bars to rhyme lyrically with the first two lines that are always the same. The melody and beat of the blues are not unlike those of a field holler. Perhaps thousands of blues were made up in this way in the fields or on the levees to relieve the monotony of working, to express some thought passing through the singer's mind, or just for fun.
Thank you. But the woman that gets me got to treat me right, 'cause I'm crazy about my loving, and I must have it all the time. It takes a brown-skinned woman to satisfy my mind, to satisfy my mind.
Could you tell us a little bit, just a sort of brief bio on Langston Hughes?
Let me get the shortest version I can. Born in Joplin, 1902. Shortly after that, his father leaves the family and goes off to live in Mexico, where he will live the rest of his life. His mother returns to Lawrence, Kansas, where her mother is still living, and where her mother's second husband, Charles Langston, had been a significant figure in the black community and in the political community period. So he grows up there until his grandmother dies in 1915. Then he spends a year with his mother, who's been gone and living, married again, and is living elsewhere. But he joins her for 1 year in a place called Lincoln, Illinois, and there he writes his first poem. Then he joins them in Cleveland, Ohio, where he goes to Central High School, and he really becomes a poet there because he publishes constantly in the school magazine, and he graduates from there in 1920. He goes to Mexico, lives with his father, reunites with his father, then goes to Columbia University in New York, where he spends a year before he decides enough of that. And then there's a period of about 5 years of wandering. He does various things. He goes off to Africa, working in the mess of a freighter, but he is able to see the peoples of West Africa. He spends a few months in Europe, living in Paris, working as a dishwasher in a club that featured black American musicians. All of this is very important to his poetry, and he listens to the music and he's writing poetry. Spends a year in Washington, D.C. in 1925. In 1926, he goes off to historically black Lincoln University in Pennsylvania. He does a B.A. in 1929. By this time, in 1929, he has published two books of poetry, The Weary Blues in 1926, and Fine Clothes to the Jew, his second volume, which is heavily blues poetry, in 1927, and the Harlem Renaissance is in full swing by 1929 when he graduates. In fact, it is probably beginning to run out of steam in 1929. In the 1930s, just to run over it very quickly, he goes very far to the left, because it's the time of the great economic depression. He has always been somewhat of a socialist. He identifies himself with the struggles of the working class, the proletariat. Does various things in the theater and elsewhere. He spends a few months in Spain in 1937 as a war correspondent during the Spanish Civil War. Eventually comes back to the United States and just continues to be what he set out to be when around 1921, which was to be a writer writing mainly about black people, but also inclusive of the rest of the world, and hoping to do nothing else with his life but be a writer. And that was a very tough decision for him to make, because it's hard for anyone to live only by his or her writings, and for him to do that while also writing about black people at that time was just a heroic decision, really.
drowsy, syncopated tune, rocking back and forth to a mellow croon. I heard a Negro play down on Lenox Avenue the other night, by the pale, dull pallor of a one-bulb light. He did a lazy sway, he did a lazy sway to the tune of those weary blues. With his ebony hands on each ivory key, he made that poor piano moan with melody. Oh, blues. Swaying to and fro on his rickety stool, he played that sad, raggy tune like a musical fool. Sweet blues. Coming from a black man's soul. Oh, blues. In a deep song voice, with a melancholy tone, I heard that Negro sing, that old piano moan. Ain't got nobody in all this world. Ain't got nobody but myself. I was going to quit my frowning and put my troubles on the shelf. Thump, 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 went his foot on the floor. He played a few chords, then he sang some more. I got the weary blues, and I can't be satisfied. Got the weary blues, and can't be satisfied. I ain't happy no more, and I wish that I had died. Far into the night he crooned that tune. The stars went out, and so did the moon. The singer stopped playing and went to bed, while the weary blues echoed through his head. He slept like a rock or a man that's dead.
Thank you.
There's one article that Langston Hughes had written, The Negro Artists and the Racial Mountain, in 1926.
Right.
And from what I understand, or from what I gathered from reading it, that seemed to be the motivation behind the Renaissance, the Harlem Renaissance.
Well, I wouldn't say that it is the motivation behind, but I would say it captures the motivation behind the Harlem Renaissance. He got the spirit of the Harlem Renaissance, especially with its emphasis on young people. Mm-hmm. What that article, which was published in the national magazine, The Nation, in 1926, what it says basically is that too many black people are ashamed of their blackness. They'll praise every other kind of music except the music of poor black people, country black people, the blues and the jazz, and that the younger black artist is not going to get anywhere unless he or she first embraces, comes to terms with the genius of black music and the genius of the African-American people, and so that racial component is essential if any kind of artistic maturity is ever going to happen. It was written in direct opposition to an essay by George Schuyler, another African-American writer, published the week before in the same magazine, where he said basically that all this talk about Negro this and Negro that is African-American this and so on, it's all silliness. We're all Americans. In fact, the article was called Negro Art Hokum. Junk. And Langston was asked to respond by the editor of The Nation, and he came up with this really definitive essay about the youth and the Harlem Renaissance and the future of African-American expressive culture.
And we've made that link available where you could read the whole piece on sugarmybowl.org. That was good to find. That's what I love about the Internet. We can still find good stuff.
The Internet is great in that respect. It has a magnificent last paragraph, that article, and I can't, of course, recite it from memory, but it talks about, you know, let the jazz bands blare and so on. We younger Negro artists are determined to reveal the truth about ourselves. We are beautiful and we are ugly too. White people are beautiful and they are ugly too. So you have to come back to what is true and what is real, and on that basis of reality and not fake bourgeois gentility, on that basis we are going to create a great art to reveal themselves and affect American culture and the generations to come.
Well, the last sentence is like, if colored people are pleased, we are glad. If they are not, their displeasure doesn't matter either. We build our temples for tomorrow, strong as we know how, and we stand on top of the mountain, free within ourselves. That's just
right. That's the racial mountain that he wanted us all to climb. He wanted younger black artists to climb, not to go around the mountain and pretend that it doesn't exist, but to climb that racial mountain and then speak from on top of it.
Well, I know he also mentioned at the beginning of the piece where he talks about the young artists and where they may get this idea. They're usually, he mentions class, the middle class. The young artists would come from a middle class environment where they are taught that white is right and what they are is not right. You know,
not right, yes, yes, yes. And in fact, this is 1926. In 1927, when he publishes his second volume of poetry called Signposts to the Jew, it's heavily inflected by the blues, and it gets savage reviews in the black press by people like W.B. Du Bois because it dared to talk about, you know, sex and the reality of black country folk culture and so on. So a lot of people thought, well, he was letting down the race. He was revealing its untidy, you know, side, or its immoral side even. And his attitude from the very beginning was that this was the truth of the culture, and there was also beauty and humanity in black life.
Right. By 1942, he started writing with the Chicago Defender.
Right. 1942, he starts a column, a weekly column in the Chicago Defender. And in 1943, he introduces in that column a character who will become very quickly the most important thing in the column for some people, and that is the character of Jesse B. Semple, otherwise known as Simple.
If you want to know about my life, said Simple, as he blew the foam from the top of the newly filled glass the bartender put before him, don't look at my face, don't look at my hands, look at my feet and see if you can tell how long I've been standing on them. I can't see your feet through your shoes, I said. You do not need to see through my shoes, said Simple. Can't you tell by these shoes I wear, not pointed, not rocking chair, not French-toed, not nothing but big, long, broad, and flat, that I've been standing on these feet a long time and carrying some heavy burdens? They ain't flat from standing at no bar, neither, because I always sets down at a bar. Can't you tell that? You know I do not hang out in a bar unless it has stools, don't you? That I have observed, I said, but I did not connect it up with your past life. Everything I do is connected up with my past life. From Virginia to Joyce, from my wife to Zarita, from my mother's milk to this glass of beer, everything is connected up. I trust you will connect up with that dollar I just loaned you when you get paid, then, I said. And who is Virginia? You never told me about her. Virginia is where I was born, said Simple. I would be born in a state named after a woman. From that day on, women never give me no peace. Ah, you, I fear, are boasting, I said. If the women were running after you as much as you ran after them, you wouldn't be able to sit here on this bar stool in peace. I don't see any women coming to call you out to go home as some of these fellows' wives do around here. Joyce better not come in no bar looking for me, said Simple. That is just why me and my wife busted up, one reason. I do not like to be called out of no bar by a female. It's a man's prerogative to just sit and drink sometimes. How do you connect that prerogative up with your past, I asked. When I was a wee small child, said Simple, I had no place to sit and think in. Being as how I was raised up with three brothers, two sisters, seven cousins, one married aunt, a common-law uncle, and the minister's grandchild. And the house only had four rooms. I never had no place just to sit and think. Neither to sit and drink, not even much my milk, before some hungry child snatched it right out of my hand. I were not the youngest, neither a girl, nor the cutest. I don't know why, but I don't think nobody liked me much. Which is why I was afraid to like anybody for a long time myself. When I did like somebody, I was full grown. And then I picked out the wrong woman because I had no practice in liking anybody before that. Me and my wife did not get along. Listen, I said, I'm still looking at your feet, and I swear they do not reveal your life to me. Your feet are no open book. You have eyes, but you see not, said Simple. These feet of mine have stood on every rock from the Rock of Ages to 135th and Lennox. These feet have supported everything from a cotton bale to a hungry woman. These feet have walked 10,000 miles working for white folks and another 10,000 trying to keep up with colored. My feet have stood at altars, crap tables, free lunches, bars, graves, kitchen doors, bedding windows, hospital clinics, WPA desks, Social Security railings, and in all kinds of lines, from soup lines to the draft. If I just had 4 feet instead of two, I could have stood in more places longer. As it is, I done wore out 700 pairs of shoes, and 89 tennis shoes, 12 summer sandals, and 6 loafers. The socks that these feet have bought could build a knitting mill. The corns I've cut away would dull a German razor. The bunions I forgot would make your feet ache from now till Judgment Day. If anybody was to write the history of my life, they ought to start with my feet. Your feet are not all that extraordinary, I said. Besides, everything you're saying is general. Tell me specifically one thing that your feet have done that makes them different from any other feet in the world. Just one. Okay. Do you see that window in that white man's store across the street? Well, this right foot of mine broke out that window in the Harlem riots right smack in the middle. Didn't no other foot in the world break that window but mine. And this left foot of mine carried me off running as soon as my right foot came down. Nobody else's feet saved me from the cops that night but these 2 feet of mine right here. Don't tell me these feet ain't had a life of their own. For shame, I said, going around kicking out windows. Why? Why, said Simple. You have to ask my great-great-grandpa why. Why did he let them capture him in Africa and sell him for a slave to breed my great-grandpa in slavery, to breed my grandpa in slavery, to breed my paw, to breed me, to look at that window and say, it ain't mine. Bam! And kick it out. This bar glass is not yours either, I said. So why don't you smash it? It's got my beer in it. That's why, said Simple.
Right.
It's a kind of black everyman, how Harlem everyman, funny guy, you know, with the wife and the girlfriend on the side.
Right.
And it's all, you know, comic, sweet, and yet still with an edge to it, you know, because Simple speaks the truth. In his own kind of semi-literate way, he speaks the truth. And Langston wanted to get that across, that voice across to his readers. And his readers in the Chicago Defender really loved Simple. And out of that column, only about a quarter of the pieces involved Simple. But out of that came, I think, 5 collections of Simple books, starting with Simple Speaks His Mind, and Simple Takes His Wife, and Simple Does This, and Simple Does That. And they were very, very popular, very effective.
Yeah, I enjoy the character also.
Well, I hope that I'm... That's the one. We're having a little, you can't tell. Or maybe you can tell. There's a little musical glitch or something happening in this studio right now. But, I just want to let you know, you've been listening to... My name's Joyce Jones. This is Sugar in My Bowl. And what we're listening to right now is In Memory Of, from Randy Weston, the birthday guy. This is High Life, from High Life, Colpix, 1963 release. Before that, we heard Feet Live Their Own Life, from Langston Hughes. And, yeah, there he is. Go ahead, Randy. Harlem in Vogue, the poetry of and jazz of Langston Hughes. That's what that was from. It's a compilation that was, it was originally recorded in 1958. Feet Live Their Own Life, but this is, the compilation was released in 2011. Before that, we heard Mood Indigo, Duke Ellington, Coleman Hawkins. That's from Duke Ellington Meets Coleman Hawkins. Coleman Hawkins on tenor saxophone, Duke Ellington on piano, Ray Nance on cornet, violin on others, Lawrence Brown on trombone, Harry Carney on baritone saxophone, bass clarinet on others, Aaron Bell on bass, and Sam Woodard on drums. This is a 1995 Impulse Records release. It was originally recorded in 1962. Before that, we heard The Weary Blues, Langston Hughes with the Leonard Feathers All-Star Sextet. This, too, was from Harlem in Vogue. A lot of the spoken word from Langston Hughes is from this release. This is from, it had Red Allen on trumpet, Vic Dickinson on trombone, Sam the Man Taylor on tenor saxophone, clarinet on others, Al Williams on piano, Milt Hinton on bass, and Ossie Johnson on drums. And The Weary Blues was originally recorded in 1958. Before that, we heard I'm Not Rough from Louis Armstrong, a compilation, the 25 Greatest Hot Fives and Hot Sevens release. United States of Distribution, originally recorded in 1929. It's a 2010 compilation. And before that, we heard The Beginning Blues, Langston Hughes, from The Story of Jazz, a Smithsonian Folkways release, originally recorded in 1954. And let's see, before that, we heard I've Known Rivers, Gary Bartz's Into Troop, from I've Known Rivers and Other Bodies, 1973 Prestige Records release. Gary Bartz on piano and alto saxophones and vocals. That was him on lead vocals there. Hubert Aves on electric and acoustic piano. Stafford James on electric and acoustic bass. Howard King on drums. Before that, we heard I've Known Rivers with an introduction from Langston Hughes, and with Langston Hughes reading that piece. This is from the teachingbooks.net blog. And if you go to the playlist, which is up on sugarinmybowl.org, if you go to the playlist, you will find out how to get access to that. And we open the show with our theme, I Want a Little Sugar in My Bowl, Nina Simone, the very best of Nina Simone. Stay tuned for more Sugar in My Bowl and Langston Hughes on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. And we'll soon be hearing from the bandstand with Hank Williams. Stay tuned.
The blues voice that Langston Hughes has, do you think that he got that from just being around people in his writing?
Well, he talks about it in I happen to have, sort of preparing for your questions, I was looking at a page of his first autobiography, The Big C, where he talks about living in 1925 in Washington, D.C. He's still a young man, 23. He hasn't published his first book. This is 1925. Mm-hmm. And he is trying to find his voice as a poet. And he talks about how he has all these very middle-class relatives here who live in Washington, D.C., while he and his mother are quite poor. And he's working in an oyster shop, opening oysters, and he's doing this, that, and the other. And so he's middle classes in his own way, but he wants to listen to what ordinary and poor black folk are doing. And he says about his own poetry, which he's working on again and again, and I'm quoting here, "I tried to write poems like the songs they sang on 7th Street, which is one of the poorer sections of Washington, D.C. at that time. Gay songs, because you had to be gay or die. Sad songs, because you couldn't help being sad sometimes. But gay or sad, you kept on living and you kept on going. Their songs, those of 7th Street, had the pulse beat of the people who keep on going." And then he follows with another paragraph, which is really short paragraph, which is really wonderful. "Like the waves of the sea coming one after another. Always, one after another, like the earth moving around the sun, and night, day, night, day, night, day, forever. So is the undertow of black music, with its rhythm that never betrays you, its strength like the beat of the human heart, its humor and its rooted power." Mm-hmm. And he follows that with six lines from the blues. And I think it's his most eloquent, moving, poetical statement about where, as far as he was concerned, the seminal significance of blues and jazz, one might say, mm-hmm. In African American literature and life.
Right. Know?
Good evening, jazz fans. This is Hank Williams, and welcome to On the Bandstand for April 6th. In this segment of the show, we bring you aerial listings of Sugar and My Bowl guests so you can experience them live. This week's show is on Langston Hughes' jazz poetry, but there's other live music to see while New York City finally seems to be hitting spring, so let's dig in. Organist Akiko Tsuruga's regular Monday night gig at Manhattan's Kotobuki restaurant continues. You can catch her there on April 7th and 14th. Details are at kotobukinewyork.com. That's K-O-T-O-B-U-K-I, newyork.com. She'll also be at Showman's in Harlem on April 11th. See showmansjazzclub.com for show details on that. That's Showman's, with an S, jazzclub.com. Pianist Mark Carey will be with the Namaskar Group at Brooklyn's Art Cafe Guerreje on the 9th. See artcafebrooklyn.wordpress.com for details. And I'll give that to you again. That's artcafebrooklyn, all one word, .wordpress.com. Drummer Jeff Tane Watts leads a quartet at the legendary and now reopened Minton's in Harlem on April 9th. Later on that night at Minton's, harpist Brandy Younger leads a quartet in a late set. You can get info for both shows at MintonsHarlem.com. That's Mintons with an S, Harlem.com. Vocalist Andy Bay will be at the Borough of Manhattan Community College's Tribeca Performing Arts Center with a cabaret jazz show on April 10th. See TribecaPAC.org. That's TribecaPAC.org, and you can get info on that show. Finally, drummer Bobby Sanabria will be performing with Eugene Marlowe's Heritage Ensemble at the Lighthouse in Manhattan on the 12th. Go to lighthouse.org for information on this show. That's all for this week. If you missed anything, you can see the listings at the Sugar and My Bowl blog. Go to sugarandmybowl.org and click the link for the blog. Tonight's playlist and audio from this and previous shows are on the main Sugar website as well. And remember that WBAI still needs financial support. Help us stay on the air by pledging whatever you can at give2, that's the number 2, WBAI.org, where you can consider becoming a WBAI buddy with a monthly pledge. This is Hank Williams signing off. We'll see you next week, Sunday, April 13th, on air and online on the Bandstand.
Yeah, Hank Williams is right. Thank you, Hank, for the bandstand. We will be back next week, and we'll be providing another poet during National Poetry Month. And as a matter of fact, we're going to present a program that we did with Amiri Baraka. And so, yay, Jazz April. Yay, National Poetry Month. Stay tuned for more Sugar in My Bowl with Arnold Rampersand and Dr. Ron McCurdy, who you'll hear from soon. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. Sugar in My Bowl is the name of this program.
Listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, the best radio station you'll ever hear.
I mean, he really could verbalize the voice of the peoples in the community.
Oh. Absolutely. I mean, he wanted to do that desperately. That was like the center of his art. He had many voices.
Mm-hmm.
It's true. I mean, there's a whole large section of Langston's poetry, which is all about the bleakness of life, loneliness, and desolation. And race is not a part of that.
Mm-hmm.
But the part we remember most of all, the part the world really cherishes, is where he explores the black community, the history of black people, the spirituality, but also their fun, their love of life, exuberance,
right,
virtuosity, and creativity. That was central to Hughes's art. I mean, other black writers didn't see it that way, and they did not produce all of them the kind of indispensable art that he left behind.
of sand and of sea.
So he eventually started, do you happen to know how he met Randy Weston when he started working with him?
No, I don't, but that takes us toward the end of his life. I know that he had worked with Randy Weston on one of Randy Weston's African albums.
Uhuru Africa.
Uhuru Africa, right.
Yeah.
And I guess he liked working with him. Langston was always working with musicians, black and white, opera, jazz, whatever.
Right.
And he kind of liked working with Randy Weston, and they had been working on this book-length poem called Ask Your Mama.
Yes.
That Hughes published in the early 60s, and it involved basically a lot of musical cues. So Weston, he was working on it, and when Langston died in 1967, and Randy Weston, of course, played at Langston Hughes' funeral. It was a very simple funeral, but his trio came and played with the funeral, by Langston's request, really.
Right, and he played Do Nothing Till You Hear From Me.
Thank you.
that was Langston Hughes scripted his funeral ahead of time, of course, and he said, you know, he didn't want a minister, didn't want too much ceremony. He wanted a little jazz band to play, and he wanted the last thing they played was going to be "Do Nothing Till You Hear From Me" by Duke Ellington.
Right.
Which is funny in a way, amusing, and I think he knew it would be amusing. I mean, to end that way, "Do nothing till you hear from me."
Right. Now, he, his piece, "A Montage of a Dream Deferred," was interpreted by Mingus, Charles Mingus.
Yes, yes, he worked with Mingus. Several jazz musicians, you know, loved working with Langston Hughes. He kept up. I mean, I can contrast him to at least one other major black writer, even more highly regarded in some circles than he is, who liked jazz, loved jazz, but loved jazz up to a certain point in the early 1940s. But once the new musicians came along, certainly people like Mingus, but also Coltrane, but even before Coltrane, Charlie Parker, this person I'm thinking of, lost interest in them, thought that they were too wild, too crazy. But Langston followed the musicians, and with every change, then the music shifted towards bebop and what used to be called progressive jazz, and became more intellectual and so on. He followed it because he really did believe that if you listen to what those great jazz musicians were playing, you would find out really the reality of African American and maybe American life.
Langston Hughes, apparently, according to The Life of Langston Hughes, Volume 2, I Dream a World, had mentioned how Langston Hughes thought of himself as a jazz poet. He wanted to be billed as a jazz poet.
Yes, yes. I mean, he liked certain billings. One of them, early on, is a little quaint. He loved to be called the poet laureate of the Negro race. And he liked to put it out there quietly. And then when people say, "Oh, you know, you are the poet laureate of the Negro race," he would say, "Oh, really? Am I that?" Even though, in fact, he was the one who put it out there.
Right? Oh, my goodness.
It was so important to him. I mean, a lot of African-American writers enjoy, that's not the right word, but have a kind of double-edged relationship to African-American readers. I mean, that's just the fact of life. I mean, but with him, he wanted a kind of total identification with the mass of black people, if he can, you know, use that term. And he never wanted to be outside. He wanted to be inside. He wanted to be loved. He wanted to be appreciated. He wanted his art to please. So, yes, and he, as I said before, he identified jazz and the blues and other forms, but mainly the jazz and the blues, as the essential sort of prophetic language of African-American culture. And so he wanted very badly to be thought of as a jazz poet and a blues poet, very much. When other people were saying, for example, County Cullen, a very fine poet in the 1920s, was saying openly, "This is not poetry. I mean, if you're going to bring jazz into it and blues, this is something you're creating, but it's not poetry. Poetry is like John Keats in England or like A. Houseman in England." I mean, that's, but then Hughes would say, no, your idea of poetry is too static. It's Eurocentric.
Right.
You wouldn't use that term, perhaps.
Right.
You're not dealing with the reality of our culture.
You mentioned Ask Your Mama earlier, and I noticed how, was it 2008 and up to the present, there was someone named Ron McCurdy who revisited it. He's with the University of Southern California.
I'm familiar with, yes, I've been in touch with Ron McCurdy, and I'm familiar with his work. Musicians have been drawn to that piece, that poem, a long poem. It's a pretty wild poem in many ways. Hughes's most experimental long poem, that's for sure. So, yes, I think McCurdy's work is excellent.
Mood 5, Blues and Stereo. Your number's coming out. Bouquets I'll send you, and dreams I'll send you, and horses shod with gold on which to ride if motor cars would be too tame. Triumphal send you, shouts from the earth itself, bare feet to beat the great drumbeat of glory to your name, and mine one and the same. You barefoot too, and the quarter of the Negroes, where an ancient river flows past huts that house a million blacks. And the white god never goes, for the moon would white his whiteness beyond its mask of whiteness. And the night might be astonished and so lose its repose. In a town named after Stanley, night each night comes nightly, and the musical old music borrowed from the horns that don't know how to play on LPs that wonder how they ever got that way. What time is it, mama? What time is it now? Makes no difference to me, but I'm asking anyhow. What time is it, mama? What time is it now? Down the long hard road that I've been hoeing, I thought I heard all horn of flint blowing, but I gotta get a new antenna, Lord. My TV, my TV keeps on snowing.
My name's Joyce Jones. I'm here with Dr. Ron McCurdy, who is the professor of music at Thornton School of Music at the University of Southern California. And you're responsible for a musical production of Ask Your Mama.
Yes.
Hi, Dr. McCurdy.
How you doing?
All right. How are you?
Good, good. Glad to be here.
Thank you so much for joining us. How did you come to work on this production?
Actually, I was professor at the University of Minnesota, Minneapolis, back in the 90s. And a colleague of mine and I were asked to put together a presentation. They were having a grand opening of the Wiseman Art Museum on campus, and they were going to have a Harlem Renaissance theme. And they wanted a show that would reflect it. They were going to have some images that were going to be displayed by Romare Bearden, Jacob Lawrence, and a few others, and they asked if we could put together a program that would reflect the Harlem Renaissance. So, of course, we said yes, and the intent was for it to be kind of a one-and-done situation, and we kind of stumbled upon this Langston Hughes' Ask Your Mama 12 Mood for Jazz, and we thought because of that having a very strong cultural message, historical message, that would be appropriate for the occasion. So we kind of pulled it together. The response was so positive, we felt that we should really try to make an attempt to really develop this. So we added the videography component. I went back and I actually composed music that would correlate with the poem. And then we began to experiment with different readers, and that was, like I said, almost 20 years ago that we did that. And so we've been fortunate enough to go all over the country presenting this Ask Your Bamba 12 Moves for Jazz by Langston Hughes.
Excellent. Now, for those who aren't aware, because I actually became aware of this production just preparing for this program, you're a trumpeter.
Yes, I am.
And you play really well. I love the music. Let me just say that straight out. This is a wonderful production, and I understand you're still touring it.
Yes, absolutely. We do about maybe between 45 and 50 concerts a year, primarily at colleges and universities and libraries all across the country.
How long have you been playing trumpet?
You're about to find my age here now. A long time. I started when I was about 12, and I'm 50-something right now, so you can do the math.
Okay. Did you, had formal training and all that, or?
Oh, yeah. I was a music major with the Florida A&M, was a music performance major, did my master's and doctorate at the University of Kansas, and I studied classical trumpet that whole time and was also doing jazz at the same time. But, yeah, I did the Hummel Trumpet Concerto, the Haydn, the Riesthager, the Hindemith, all those classical pieces. I did all that and still do.
Well, that explains why you sound really great. In addition to just having the soul, I mean, this piece is just so amazing. How long did it take you to come up with the music?
Well, it took me roughly about 6 months.
Okay.
I collaborated with a former student of mine, Eli Brueggemann, who's now the musical director for Saturday Night Live. He was a student of mine here at USC around early 2000, 2001. And he was in one of my classes called Jazz and Culture. And he was someone who was just always quite astute and always did his assignments and always had a lot to say in class. And he was also a wonderful pianist. So I said, well, would you like to collaborate with me on this project? And he said, of course. So he and I would meet at my house every Tuesday for about 5 or 6 hours. And we would read the poem and try and figure out what was Langston trying to say here. Because if you've read the poem, it's a very densely written poem.
Right.
A real history lesson, because he's talking about Nkrumah and Nasser and Zeke Ezekwe and Nina Simone and John Coltrane and Adam Clayton Powell. Some names that people who aren't necessarily historians may not necessarily know. And he's talking about different places in his life, because he talks about Brazil and Carnival happening in Haiti. I mean, so it's a very densely written poem. So we would read the poem and try to come up with sounds and music that would correlate with the poem. I must also tell you that Langston had written what we call musical cues, because he had planned to collaborate with Charles Mingus and also Randy Weston when he wrote this piece. But Langston, he's passed away before they could actually realize the work as they had intended to have it be accompanied with live music. There was a piece that Langston had written years ago called The Weary Blues with Charles Mingus. So I think he was planning on doing the same thing with Ask Your Mama 12 Moves for Jazz. We were the first to actually compose music that would correlate with the poem.
And I understand you recruited our friend Damani Baker to work on the images, the video.
Yes. Damani was the one that did images for us. And so he and Eli Brueggemann were good friends, and Eli was the one who turned me on to Damani.
Oh, okay.
And Damani did a fantastic job with the images. It really just helps to bring the whole poem to life, because what we thought was, as we were talking about Zeke Ezekwe or Nasser and Nkrumah or Farbus or Issa, some of the starting segregationists, we would have images that would correlate, and that way people who didn't know who those people were could at least kind of have a correlation between the names and now seeing their images on the screen. This is a multimedia presentation that really allows the audience to not only be entertained, but also be educated, which is my primary mission with this program.
How do you decide where you're going to go? How do we get to see you here in New York?
Well, I've been trying to get to the Schoenberg for years. You know, so basically I serve as my own manager and agent.
Okay.
So I have a list of venues, and I just call people and say, look, we have this project. We'd love to come to your venue. And I send them to my website, and I send them excerpts of it. And when people like it, they call us and say, yes, we want to do this.
Wow.
And most recently, we've been working with Malcolm Jamal Warner from The Cosby Show. He's been fantastic to work with. People know him as Theo, but I think he's certainly evolved from that particular role. He's a grown man.
Yes, he is. There is some video on YouTube, just so people know. But in the video that I've seen, you've also had Ice-T reading with you as well.
Yes. And that was amazing. We did that back in 2008. We have an orchestral version that we did with the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra. And Ice-T was amazing to work with as well. I mean, he brought a whole different edge to Langston Hughes. And people often ask me, if Langston Hughes were around today, what would he be? And my response is, he would probably be a rapper, because he was a storyteller. He was someone, it would be cerebral rap. It wouldn't be misogynistic. It would be about important issues concerning our own journey in life.
Right.
How do you get musicians? Do you choose different musicians when you go to different towns?
I have my regular band here in Los Angeles that I work with.
Okay.
But when the recession hit, it became almost cost prohibitive for me to travel with my band because a lot of schools and budgets were cut. So we had to take a reduction in fees. And as you might imagine, our biggest expense is our travel expense, like getting us to, like, you know, Nashville, Pennsylvania, getting us to Columbus, Ohio. We have to, you know, that's four airplane tickets, and that's, you know, having to travel with our acoustic bass, which is another plane ticket in itself. So what I started doing about maybe 5 or 6 years ago, I traveled with a piano player here from Los Angeles. And because I've been in the music business for such a long time, I know people everywhere we go. So I hire a bass player and a drummer wherever we're going, and I send them the music, the scores, and I send them the MP3s of the music so they can do some homework while we have rehearsals, and then we go ahead and do the performance. And it's really worked out well because each performer, and I find like the top guys wherever we're going, and they really do their homework. We come together, and it's really amazing because they all bring something different to each performance because I'm using different bass players and different drummers wherever I go. And it keeps me fresh, and it keeps the whole presentation fresh.
Well, I really look forward to the time that it makes it to the Schaumburg. Make sure you let me know so I get my ticket first.
I will certainly do that, Joyce. I certainly will.
Well, thank you so much, Ron McCurdy, Professor Dr. Ron McCurdy, for explaining the Ask Your Mama production. And how do people get you if they do want to have it in their town?
They can look on my website, which is www.ronmccurdy.com. And McCurdy is M-C-C-U-R-D-Y. And my phone number, all my contact information is there, my cell number, my email address. So hopefully people will call. So like I said, we're busy. We're busy, and I really want to be sometime because I'm full professor here at USC, and that's my primary function. But I look at the Langston Hughes Project as sort of being an expansion of my classroom because I always end up doing a session on the Harlem Renaissance, or I do a session on the Langston Hughes or Zora Neale Hurston or Richard Wright or Bontemps. So I always make it a point to do that as well. But people can go to my website and find me and call me and send me an email, and we'll be happy if we can make it work. We'll be more than happy to come to your venue.
Oh, that would be wonderful. And it's definitely, your work is a connection of the university and the communities. So that's a wonderful thing all by itself.
Thank you, Jonas. Thank you so much for calling. And I enjoyed talking to you, and thank you for being a trooper and with the whole telling the stories of life and exposing these kinds of projects to the world. These are the kind of things that I think people really need to know about and just be exposed to, because it helps us as a people to understand who we are and how we can better engage in this tango dance that we find ourselves in, of being able to coexist with one another.
Well, thank you, Ron McCurdy.
Bye-bye.
They rang my bell to ask me, could I recommend a maid? I said, why, yes. Yo mama.
Elie Siegmeister, an American composer, said that Hughes was the most musical poet of the 20th century, in America at least, and a lot of composers and musicians in general have been drawn to his work, and So there's a big body of work out there, attests to the fact that Hughes had something going where music was concerned that a lot of other writers simply didn't want to have, even, you know. Mm-hmm. They didn't see the value of it, but he did.
Yeah, in that respect, I believe he was indeed ahead of his time.
Oh, yeah.
And he also was Black Nativity and Tambourines of Glory sort of opened up theater in a way that hadn't been experienced before.
Well, Hughes was drawn to the theater from early on. I mean, his first play is written around 1929-30. And through the 30s, he produces plays. In the 1940s, he works on various operas and so on, white composers, also black composers. Mm-hmm. William Grant Still, the black composer, they did an opera called Troubled Island with Kurt Weill, the German emigre composer. They mm-hmm. did a street scene, which was very successful on Broadway. And then Hughes' interest in sort of the musical stage just began to build. And in the 50s and 60s, he began to explore, and he claims to have invented the form of the gospel musical. Mm. So I don't know if that is true, but it seems to be true that he was the first person to come forward and put on a play where the key music and the persistent music is the music of gospel singers and gospel composers. He has Tambourines to Glory, you mentioned that, and then there is the one, Black Nativity, mm-hmm. That is played so very often at Christmas.
Right.
And there are others, too, in that same form, musical plays that draw on gospel, the blues, and the spirituals. Yeah.
The Mule Bone, the collaboration he had done with Zora Neale Hurston. Could you tell us about that?
Well, that's one of the... They're more kind of, interesting, moments in Hughes' career. Around 1929-30, they had been great friends, Hurston and Hughes. And there was a lot between them, and that was similar, more than any two writers of the Harlem Renaissance. They loved the blues and loved country, black people, and so on. So they seemed like a natural to get together and create this play based on black folklore of the South called Mule Bone. But certain things happened, and they had a patron, just to give a kind of shorthand account of what happened, and the patron and Hughes sort of fell out, and Hurston decided she needed to put some distance between herself and Langston. So although they most definitely had written this play together, she said Hughes had nothing to do with it. So she was trying to peddle the play as being written only by herself, and she and Hughes had a break around 1931 that was never mended, and it was really quite tragic in a way. And Mule Bone was never produced until long after both of them were dead. It was not a successful production in terms of audience response in Lincoln Center, but that's the sad story of Mule Bone. But, you know, in one way, it was typical of a lot of what Hughes experienced, and that is that the theater, so much of what he did there, I mean, he was very enthusiastic about it, but he was always getting into some kind of controversy or the other, some sort of fight or the other with composers or with, even though he was a very easygoing man. But maybe that sort of thing comes with the territory of the theater and, you know, the musical. So many moving parts that you're bound to have clashes and whatnot. But on the whole, he was a success in his work for the musical stage and also for the ordinary theater, conventional theater. So, and he was very happy and proud to have contributed there. Hughes was he has to be seen as the most versatile of all African-American writers, and certainly among the most versatile of all American writers. He worked in so many areas, mm-hmm. Whether it's poetry, whether it's the novel, whether it's a short story, whether it's a theater, histories, children's books. He has about a dozen children's books, extremely versatile. So he was always sort of testing himself. But I think the most important work for him was the work that he did that involved jazz and the blues. Most important.
I guess with regard to the theater and his experience with that, that's why he wrote a note on commercial theater.
Oh, yes. You've taken my blues and gone.
Yes.
I have a copy there. I don't
yes,
have a
I
copy
do.
In front of me.
Yes,
but,
I do.
You've taken my blues and gone. You sing them on Broadway, and you sing them in Hollywood Bowl. You mixed them up with symphonies, and you fixed them so they don't sound like me. Yep, you've done taken my blues and gone. You also took my spirituals and gone. You put me in Macbeth and Carmen Jones and all kind of swing Mikados and in everything but what's about me. But someday somebody'll stand up and talk about me and write about me, black and beautiful, and sing about me and put on plays about me. I reckon it'll be me myself. Yes, it'll be me.
Yeah, that's worth remembering. Yes, because he lived all his life seeing other people appropriating, you know, black cultural forms, especially dance, blues, jazz, and black people, a lot of them, including himself, remaining relatively poor, while others got rich off of the traditions. So he wrote that poem.
Right.
It's worth remembering.
A most important entry here. How much Langston Hughes affected Amiri Baraka, Leroy Jones, and vice versa. I understood that Langston Hughes really started to enjoy the existence of Leroy Jones and Amiri Baraka.
Well, the story begins really in the late 1950s when Leroy Jones living especially in the village, mm-hmm. In essentially a predominantly white environment, the Beat generation. He
right.
was a kind of beat poet when he edited journals with his then wife, and with at least one other collaborator. Their main interest really was sort of avant-garde poetry, Greenwich Village, sort of that world. Allen Ginsberg would
right.
be one of their major poets. And Hughes heard about this poet and began to look at some of the work he was doing. Poetry that Leroy Jones published in the first volume he has, which is called Preface to a 20-volume suicide note.
Mm-hmm.
And Hughes sought him out. Hughes was very generous that way. He wrote to him and said, you know, this is great stuff. I'd love to meet you sometime. And but then the next major point in their careers, really, is when Jones begins to turn towards the black arts movement in the face of the assassinations of Malcolm and others and so on. In 1965, he kind of gives up Greenwich Village and he goes up to Harlem, and he is essentially preaching at that point a kind of separatism, and his plays become pretty rough stuff,
mm-hmm.
The Toilet and The Slave and
mm-hmm.
before that Dutchman.
Right.
And he has a little trouble, you know, because he is of another generation altogether, maybe two other generations. So he has a little bit of trouble dealing with this more embittered, militant Leroy Jones still. He becomes Amiri Baraka a little bit later. But they admired one another very much, and they also are cut from the same cloth, really, I would say. I mean, they have much more in common than they have that sets them apart.
Well, it definitely seemed as though the Renaissance and the Black Arts Movement was just two different periods, but the same principle.
I think so. I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, it was sometimes forgotten, but yeah, it's the same impulse. It's the same Negro artist on the racial mountain, except that Hughes is speaking, because he's in 1926, at a time that is like prehistoric in terms of race consciousness for us. When you think of what black people were subjected to in those days. But basically, what he's proclaiming is what the so-called militants of the 1960s and 70s would proclaim, maybe more vociferously later on, but the essential principle is still the same, which is that you have to respect yourself and respect your culture and listen to your musicians, your artists, allow them to tell the truth and honor them, and not turn your back on them and think that the truth and beauty and achievement, you know, lie in some other direction.
Is there anything that you think people generally don't know about Langston Hughes that you think they should remember?
I don't know. I mean, at one time Hughes, you know, after his death, his reputation started to go down, and then it slowly began to turn around, and a lot of young people are introduced to poetry through Langston Hughes and a few other poets sort of like him, who have a certain kind of beauty and an almost innocent quality to them, even though you also have a social message involved in there generally. So Hughes is fairly well known. Now that you ask me, I mean, I think that what strikes me about Hughes is his extraordinary dedication to his craft, to the mission that he set himself early on. He was a very cheerful person on the surface. He was a very loving, friendly, and generous person, unbelievably, to other writers, younger people, and so on. But I think we sometimes forget how much he suffered one way or another because of racism, because of competition, competitiveness on the part of other people, people not having the same principles that he did. But, I mean, overall of that, he had this indomitable spirit. I mean, he was determined to succeed. He was determined not to go down. He had this little expression he used toward the end of his life, still here, you know. you think you've killed me, but no, I'm still here. And wow. I'm going to keep laughing and loving, and I'm going to keep going on. So that tremendous optimistic spirit, which he identified with African-American culture as a whole. I mean, he thought it was an essential part of the humanity, the destiny, the secret of black life. He wrapped himself up in that ethos, that world. And to answer your question, I mean, I think one has to see the sacrifice he made to be the person he was, to make the contribution he did. But ultimately, I think one has to fasten on the success he made of his struggle to assert himself and to proclaim the beauty and humanity of his major subject, which was African-American people, black American people.
Well, thank you so much, Arnold Rampersad, for spending this time with us. I'm so appreciative, and I really am honored by your presence.
Well, it's my pleasure. I enjoy the conversation very, very much.
I, too, sing America. I am the darker brother. They send me to eat in the kitchen when company comes, but I laugh and eat well and grow strong. Tomorrow, I'll be at the table when company comes. Nobody'll dare say to me, eat in the kitchen, then. Besides, they'll see how beautiful we are and be ashamed. I, too, am America.
All right. Thank you indeed, Arnold Rampersad, for sharing your experience, actually your writings, your teachings, two volumes of Langston Hughes. Thank you so much. And what we're listening to right now is A Foggy Day from Charles Mingus. I realize I didn't play any of those cuts that Langston Hughes did with Charles Mingus, but he did indeed record with him on Weary Blues. And let's see, before that, we ended with Langston Hughes getting the last word. I, too, from the voice of Langston Hughes. This is originally recorded in 1963. It is a 1995 Smithsonian Folkways release. And before that, we heard Mood Indigo. Oh, nope, wait. No, not that one. We heard Note on the Commercial Theater, Langston Hughes with Leonard Feather's All-Star Sextet. As I mentioned before, the playlist is up on sugarmybowl.org. So it's the same lineup that was mentioned earlier with Red Allen on trumpet, Vic Dickinson on trombone, Sam the Man Taylor on tenor saxophone, clarinet on others, Al Williams on piano, and Milt Hinton on bass. Ossie Johnson on drums, and this was originally recorded in 1958. It's a 2011 Fingertips Records release. And before that, we heard, which page am I on? Oh, yes. We heard from Ask Your Mama. Dr. Ron McCurdy's Ask Your Mama with text by Langston Hughes. These were a couple of excerpts from a YouTube video that is actually was provided on Sugar in My Bowl, sugarinmybowl.org. So if you go over there, you can check out the production. It's about an hour and a half, something like that. It's a lengthy one, but it's a good one. Ask Your Mama, 12 Moods for Jazz. And before that, we heard Do Nothing Till You Hear From Me. That was Randy Weston, the yesterday birthday guy, along with my sister Leeser. And our former sugar guest, Pat Thomas. His birthday was yesterday as well, April 6th. And today is Billie Holiday's birthday. Let's see, Randy Weston Trio with Cecil Payne with These Hands. Randy Weston on piano, Cecil Payne, baritone saxophone, Ahmed Abdul Malik on bass, and Wilbert Hogan on drums. And that was a 1956 Riverside Records release. Before that, we heard the second movement, African Lady. It was co-written by Langston Hughes. The text was by Langston Hughes. Randy Weston from Uhuru, Africa, 1960 Roulette Records release. And before we heard The Bandstand, we heard In Memory Of by Randy Weston from High Life, a 1963 Culpix Records release. And yes, as mentioned, it was a good segue that we talked about, Arnold Rappersand and myself talked about Amiri Baraka, because that's who our guest is next week. We're going to present our program that we had done with Amiri, Hank Williams and myself, and our videographer at the time, Kazembe Balagoon. He's kind of busy these days with little Miles, the baby, and Sister Claudia, and plenty of work, so we don't get to get with him that much, but we were able to visit the Barakas in Newark, and it was a chilly night, and fortunately he was very generous. Amiri Baraka was very generous with his time, and so you'll get to hear the fruits of that labor. And then our next guest, our last April Jazz Appreciation Month / National Poetry Month guest is going to be Jesus Papaleto Melendez. And I should be sharing that time with Hank Williams. We're going to tag team Papaleto Melendez. So looking forward to that. And so stay tuned. Coming up will be La Nueva Alternativa. And enjoy the Central Brooklyn Jazz Consortium. That's still going. That's going on. That's just going on for the month of April. If you listen to World of Jazz, I'm sure you've heard plenty about that, which is Tuesday nights. Stay tuned. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. I'd also like to thank Ron McCurdy, if I didn't, Dr. Ron McCurdy, for explaining Ask Your Mama. Stay tuned. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 and 99.5 FM, WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl will be back next Sunday. Let's listen to some more Mingus.
Hello? Bueno, this is Sonia Sanchez. I urge you to give your generous support to listener-sponsored community radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York.